Okay, good morning. It is still morning. It actually just turned afternoon and new season, new look. I think firstly, Arthur, welcome to you as well. From both of us, we want to say thank you for everybody that's overwhelmingly listened to it. We're in the hundreds of thousands of downloads, and that's really such a privilege and completely exceeded our expectations. We hopefully will be better for you this year, and we certainly are kicking off on a brilliant note. We have our local Dylan Fratelli with us this morning. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no worries. Good to be here, boys.
Dylan, myself, I know Arthur knows you now for quite some time, but it's certainly also a starstruck moment for me this morning. Always been a big fan of you in professional golf. And I like your humor online.
I think we're going to dive into
We're going to
that a
dive into
little
that
bit
a little
today.
bit.
That's the topic of discussion.
It certainly is part of the topic of conversations. But Dylan, like we always do, just acknowledging the people that surround you and your team. So thank you very much for making the time available to us
Yeah, no
today.
worries. Back in South Africa now, so always happy to chat to some local people and spread the word on my game and my sponsors and just the game in general.
If you don't mind, somewhere right there, speaking about South Africa, we were just talking about the training facilities at Leopard Creek. Do you mind somewhere diving into that? Apparently,
Yeah.
it's just world class. I
I
haven't
just
had
got
the.
back from Leopard, what, a week ago, just under a week ago, and it was such a fun week. The golf course is immaculate. They switched to Bermuda grass. I think 3 years ago, I played one previous downhill there, but now the practice facilities are amazing. I mean, par three course, massive range, probably 200 meter long teeing ground area that you can hit from, and then chipping greens, putting greens. It's a really cool spot. So along with the golf course and that practice facility, that place is it's like Candyland for a golfer, to be honest.
What are the internationals things when they come to Leopard? Because obviously they're used to great facilities and
Yeah.
courses, but you're certainly not used to seeing a lion and elephant in the same hole that you play.
Yeah, that's. I was sending a bunch of pictures back to friends in America that had never seen it, and they were just like, "What the heck's going on here?" They didn't quite understand. And then I did some commentary as well with the guys, and they obviously put in the middle little bits of animals, and then they even took a camera into the park, so they got some really cool shots of different animals. While I was on, they showed probably six, seven different species. So, no, it's an awesome place, and that's kind of what I enjoy doing when I come back to South Africa. I never really go into the bush. I always tell myself I'm going to go on a trip. I'm going to go do a weekend away, and I never do it, but at least I have Leopard Creek on the schedule for me to see a few animals and get those vibes.
Did your friends in America get the kudu guess that you did on Instagram?
Yeah, so I to tell the fans out there that don't follow my Instagram, I put a female kudu that walked across the road one morning. It was the second round, just beautiful kudu walking across, and I filmed it and I said, "What animal is this?" And I had probably 100 responses, and 89 or 90 of those were deer. It's a deer. I'm like, okay,
And
so
probably 10% reindeer.
possibly, but I explained to them, okay, you say deer, that's cool. And then others were antelope. Probably 10 people said antelope. And I said, okay, if I ask you, what is this vehicle here? You go, oh, that's a car. Like, yes, it's a car. But my
Car.
question was, what brand and model of car is this? And they didn't understand that. They're like, no, it's an antelope. Yes, it's an antelope, but specifically, it's a kudu. So I had to try and, like, I guess, educate some Americans on our different types of antelope.
I tell you, it's always been, and it is literally. I mean, now that you said that, I thought we were past the point where they thought we were roaming with lions and elephants all the time. But clearly, we still have that reputation.
It's still there. I know quite a few people in the States that they really have no clue where South Africa is. The best thing for me whenever I'm asked the question, "Where are you from?" and I go, "Okay, I'm going to give you a quiz. Yeah, I'm not from Antarctica. I'm not from Asia. I'm not from Australia, New Zealand. I'm not from North America. I'm not from South America. Not from Europe. Where, like, what? I don't. I, what do you? No, I don't know. I don't understand." And I go, "Well, I've eliminated six continents. There's only one left." And they just stare at me and they go, "I don't know. I don't understand." And I'm like, "It's the big one, right in the middle, massive, like largest land mass." And I have no. I literally have to say Africa. And "You're from Africa? Wow, that's amazing. But like, your geography is so bad, you can't figure that out. Why does it even matter where I'm from if you don't know where that place is?"
And just to jump ship a little bit, I know a lot of people know who's sitting in front of us, but we asked you for your top five most personal achievements.
Yeah.
And you mentioned John Deere
Yep.
Classic, the NCAA Championship.
Yep.
You mentioned the Byron Nelson Awards.
Yep.
The Austrian Open.
Yep.
And then the Masters and Open. You're finishing at five.
Fives, yeah.
Those moments must have been very special for you.
If you had to categorize them?
That's why I added in. It was hard to kind of put those down because then I'm leaving out winning
exactly.
Boys. I'm leaving out winning Freddie Tate. But for me, I just listed in the categories of biggest win for sure. For me, NCAA team championship, that still feels like the biggest victory for me. I mean, University of Texas has a long golfing tradition. They won their last national championship back in, it's 40 years before, so 1972, before I won it in 2012 with my team. And then subsequently, the guys actually won it last year, this past summer. So recent history has been good, but that was a huge moment for the university. I made the winning putt at Riviera Country Club, so that for me, the emotions and the adrenaline and everything all added up. Had Spieth in the team there, and it was a pretty cool experience. I don't think even winning John Deere for me was like, that was a cool personal goal, but when you have more people involved and a bigger fraternity, it definitely amps up that achievement. So for me, that's definitely still my biggest victory. John Deere Classic, awesome. PGA Tour, tick that box. But and then Austrian Open was my first European Tour win. I could throw in their Challenge Tour wins as well, but. And then I guess I put Byron Nelson quite high up there. That was the award given to the top collegiate, so NCAA golf, the golfer and academic and like community outreach. So I actually shared that with somebody. So it wasn't all my own, but that for me is pretty proud. Having done 4 years at the University of Texas and then being acknowledged as the best athlete, community and academic. So yeah, and then I guess, what was the last one? The top fives, Masters and British Open. I mean, majors, that's the final pinnacle for me to win one of those. Maybe even a WGC in between the PGA Tour event. But yeah, top five, those two majors, pretty exhilarating and just gives me hope for the future that I can compete again.
Yeah, and I suppose it sort of solidifies your journey as you go along. But what's interesting to me is, what's the qualities that you see yourself on that level of golf? Now, there's a lot of South African golfers and that's would love to have your profile, and it's probably the dream that they're chasing. Yeah. But what do you see is the qualities that you guys share at that top performing?
That's a good question. For me, the number one thing I would say is just, I mean, it's not one exact thing, but I can build a little framework for a personality. For me, it's persistence, intelligence and
hard work.
Hard work's in there, but anyone can do hard work. It's not smart and hard work, it's going nowhere. You can hit 1500 balls a day, it doesn't help you unless you have a really good coach, unless you have a really good practice plan set out, unless you have a schedule where you're working towards certain tournaments to achieve something at those tournaments. Hard work means nothing. I mean, you can go and work in the field on your farm and do hard work and all you're doing is moving boulders, but you haven't built a field, you haven't built a road, you haven't built a fence. So if you don't have a plan, if you don't have people around you that are intelligent, that have been there before, so that's the biggest key for me, because I see so many guys that can hit a golf ball in South Africa or be it America, but they don't understand how to put the pieces together. And I think for me, the big thing was learning at a young age. Both my parents were good athletes. They understood sort of what it took to get to the top level. My dad played provincial sport, my mom played provincial sport and national level stuff, so they always knew, okay, you got to get a coach, you got to have a tournament to see where your standard is compared to other people, and you got to put all these pieces together to get to that top level. So that's my simple answer, I would say, is just the intelligent hard work done on a daily basis and being committed to it. I can't say for other people. I mean, obviously Ernie, Retief, those are the guys that I looked up to. I don't know what their formula is, but for me, that's my personal opinion.
Then I really like your perspective, what you say there, because even amateurs, we understand very well, not in the same relatable sense. Your mindset's right for the day, you just play a different game. It's amazing how the mind and the swing comes together. And what I just enjoyed what you said there is, we always simplify it by saying a lot of people has got a swing, but it's the mind that ultimately makes the difference. But what you're saying is there is, you have to work towards something, and that's part of the mind journey as well. Yeah. So training with purpose, and we always say it, Arthur and I always speak about it.
Multiple times.
And what's so funny, recently we found out that, you know, if you look at junior golfers or school golf, they send them to the driving range for 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
Guys come back with bad habits. Yeah. If there's no guidance there, you know, nobody's there skilled enough to say, you're doing this wrong, or what are we practicing on?
Yeah.
And like you say, I think it's to tick a box. and say, listen, I hit my 1,200 shots for the day or 500 shots. And, you know,
how many of those were hit with intent? Did you hit 10 and 1,200? I would much rather, I mean, it's almost a cliche now, the last 10 years people have said it, but I'd rather hit 100 balls with 100% intent than hit 1,000 balls with, I'm just out just sort of hitting, kind of maybe focused.
I also saw Henny Duplessis commented, I think at Alfred Daniel, he was saying that one of the guys interviewing him asked what has changed with Henny Duplessis in the last year. Obviously, he had some good results on the Live Tour. His world golf rankings has improved tremendously. What's changed? And he said, obviously, working with Grant Veenstra has helped him a lot, but Grant has actually put in a structure
to his practice.
So like practice with a purpose, you know, going to the range and actually having, let's call it homework to do and preparation to do before the tournament, which I think he's a very natural golfer. You get what I'm saying? And he's a very, very good ball striker as well. So he had that natural ability, but putting a bit of structure, practice with a purpose to it has actually added huge benefit to his game.
The other side to it, I personally take control of every aspect of my golf, but not many guys are either smart enough to figure out their own schedule and smart enough to make some technical adjustments. But you see everyone on the PGA Tour, they have a team of guys. Like I have one coach, I have a swing coach, I've got a sports psychologist, those other aspects, but I actively seek them out and ask them for advice. But you can go the other way and you can just be someone that I'm going to play golf. I'm appointing you as my manager, you as my whatever you want to call him. You go and find me the best guys for chipping, putting, psychology, and then you trust somebody else that you don't have to worry about it. So that's another thing that I've had to work out in my game is delegating and finding ways to get better such that I'm not the one actively focused. I mean, Arthur and I have played a lot of golf together. He knows I plan the flights, the bookings, that I have everything planned out there. But I've realized, hey, if I'm spending 8 hours a week or 6 hours a week on doing that stuff, it's probably not the best thing for me. Someone else can do that. That's a menial job that I don't need to be doing. So little things like that. There's not one true right way to do it, but I think there's definitely a scale where, hey, you appoint someone to help you out and do all that stuff, or you take control and you do it all yourself.
Dylan, I suppose, because I also know that you have a business mind, but it is a little bit like business as well, you know, where you gear yourself up to maximize the potential, to prepare as best as possible. And certainly not, you know, we always try and strive as a bit of a cliche for that perfection, but we always say 90% normally gets you across the road.
Yeah.
And if you consistently deliver at 90%, that's normally the success rate. If you look at stats like Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, there is nothing like perfection. If there was ever a stat or a persona that you would say, you know, has done it perfectly, you still only had a 12% winning rate, you know, as Tiger Woods. So it's so far away from what we always think. But I also think, Dylan, from where you come from out of Texas and what you're surrounded with, I think you'll be surprised. I think a lot of people still practice with no purpose and plan.
Yeah.
I think, you know, maybe South Africa, I still see it a lot in amateurs and in professionals.
I see on a daily basis, University of Texas, where I still practice, we've got probably the number one recruiting class over the last 5 years, top players. You got Scotty Scheffler, Doug Gim, guys that have come out there, Bo Hostler, in the last 6 years. I mean, these guys are top PGA Tour winners. And the similar guys now that are coming through the college system, I still look at them. And I got on someone the other day. I said, bro, what are you doing looking at your cell phone? What do you mean? Well, you're chipping. You hit 10 chip shots. You pull out your cell phone. You send a text message. You maybe check something else on Instagram. And then you put your phone away. I said, you're breaking your concentration now. You've hit 10 shots. Now you got to get back into the mindset of hitting. Just put your phone away. Go and put it in your locker. You don't need it. Nothing's going to change in 10 minutes, 5 minutes, or 10 shots. So little things like that. I mean, I've learned that over the years. Maybe I did that early on in my career. I don't know. Cell phone wasn't really in my pocket. But hey, you're out here, you're playing golf. Focus, do the golf. Why? Who cares about other stuff? So I see it everywhere. I mean, even on the PGA Tour, same thing. Guys have their phone in their back pocket during a practice round and they're on the phone and they're doing all this stuff. And I'm thinking, how does this guy not work it out? Like, that is totally counterintuitive to what he's trying to do. You're trying to get good at golf. You're trying to focus. You're trying to do all this stuff. And yet you're having all these distractions pop up that are going to take away from your overall performance and ability to get better.
I was wondering why it was so difficult to get hold of you over the phone. It makes sense now.
Because
he's chipping. He's chipping.
It's on airplane mode. You can't get hold of me. I don't want you to get hold of me.
I get you.
How I respond with a text message to your phone calls or your voice notes.
Mm.
Because I don't want to give you the time, Arthur. That's why.
I'll accept it.
I feel the same way, Dylan.
At least I know where I sit.
I also just
everybody else. Don't worry. It's all in the same bucket.
Well, Dylan, it's you know, a lot of people would probably, but it's good that you take the time to notice that with people. When Eric van Rooyen came, he was the first guy we had on, gave us such a nice head start on the podcast. And that night he said to Arthur, you know, critical, some good points that he raised, and I'll never forget it. And if you are mature enough, you want criticism, and, yeah, and especially from people that's been there and done that. And I always say the people that's taken the time, it comes from absolute place of love and care. It can't come from another place unless it, you know, looks
it's over Instagram. Exactly.
Like, but there we go. Yeah. There we go. Then it might have a double meaning to it. Well, you've achieved some great stuff, but tell me, what was your worst sports performance in your mind, and what have you learned from that?
I was a terrible swimmer in primary school. I refused to do swimming. My mother had a swim school as a kid, and I sat on the side of the pool, so I don't know what happened there, but swimming was my worst sport growing up. But pretty much everything else I played and did, I did well. I played four provincial sports when I was growing up. I captained Gauteng North hockey team, soccer team under 13s, and went to St. Albans for high school, played first team cricket and hockey in grade 9, standard 7, I guess, form 2, three different versions of schooling there.
Dad said it was always going to be something with a stick, huh?
And then I played baseball and golf, obviously, at provincial level. So it was like, if I liked something, I was going to go and do it 100%. So I guess swimming I didn't like, so I never did it well. But worst performance ever, here's an interesting one. South African boys under 16 played at Glendower. I was meant to play the national hockey tournament for Gauteng North under 16s, and I got pneumonia 2 weeks before the tournament. So I thought, hang on, I can't do this cardio-wise. I won't keep up with the hockey, but I can walk around a golf course, right? So I was exempt for the tournament. I'll go play Glendower. Cool. I was still 15 years old, or 14 actually, and I finished like 22nd or 20th, I remember. And I was like, hang on, these guys are playing golf full-time, all the time. I'm playing all the other sports, and then in the holidays I'll practice a bit of golf, and I'm able to be like the 20th ranked under 16 in the country. Like, I must be pretty decent. And that was the thing that actually pushed me to go and play golf, because I was like, I've coming off pneumonia, I finished 20th, surely if I practice a little bit I can beat these guys every day. And that was luckily the case that pushed me to go and focus solely on golf at 15 or 16 years old, and that's, I guess, the major thing that helped me get to where I am now.
You just answered.
So bad performance, 20th and under 16. There's my
okay, good. So, or a little bit of illness and a moment of let me go and try something else. Yeah. Turned out to be your son today. Yeah. How the world works sometimes in blocks. And in golf, at what stage did you get so? At what stage did you feel so? Life's a journey for all of us. Yeah. So if you're a professional golfer at 21, we see you on TV, we almost think you've got it all worked out. You know, that's what perception does.
Yeah.
The TV only shows your best shots. It shows your best moments. So you create that perception. But when did you start to feel like, hold on, I'm really taking control of this. I've learned lessons. I'm now growing as a golfer, and I'm actually going to be able to make this quite big.
That's a hard question.
There's levels to it, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, you won $7 million at some stage. How did you get there?
I mean, for me,
dollars.
The important thing is, I explain this to junior golfers whenever I've got a buddy here who practices in Johannesburg, and I said to him, look, these are the things you have to knock out. There's your local club, like winning junior club champs, winning the club champs. That's like first level. Then you got to win a citywide junior foundation tournament. Cool. Then you've got to be able to represent that state team in an age group, be it 12, 16, 18, whatever it is. Then you got to play national 72-hole amateur tournaments. And while you're doing all these things, you have to win multiple times at each of those levels. And that's what I've done every single step. Once you're beyond that, now you're winning a national 72-hole tournament. Now you're going to represent the country, be it under 16, under 18, senior amateur team. Once you've done that, now you're looking international. Now you're going to play against the rest of the world. You got to win over there. So those steps at each level, I felt, okay, I've won my club champs at 12 years old. Sorry, junior club champs 12. Then I won my club champs at 14. So now all of a sudden, okay, what's the next step? And I was always looking for that next avenue. And I've won at every single level. I won as an amateur overseas. I won as a college player overseas. I was an All-American there. I won 36-hole Big Easy event here, my first year on the Sunshine Tour. So that's even a little intermediate step to pro golf. Then I won 72-hole tournament my first year on the Challenge Tour in Europe. So each of these steps, you feel like, okay, I belong here. Can I excel? Can I get to the top? Yes, I've won. Now you open up. What's the next step? So I would tell you that the moment that I felt like I was there happened 8, 10, maybe 12 times on each level.
Yeah.
So lots of guys choose to skip those levels. They go, oh, I'm going to go to Sunshine Tour School. Hang on, buddy. Have you won an amateur event yet?
Mm.
Have you represented your province? Have you played in the national tournament? Yes, no. You might want to think twice about that. It's like a business. You're not going to go, I'm going to open up 15 stores now, one in each province, and it's going to go great. No, no, you're going to try one in Gauteng. If that works, okay, now we're going to try one in Durban. Is that going to work? Yes. And you're going to do your research. You're not just going to blindly go into something. So that's my answer, is each level I've ticked the box, and now PGA Tour is my biggest win. There's still majors, there's still another level there. So I still have something to work towards. There's still another level to it.
But you're only 31 now. You're very mature.
Yeah.
So 31, yes, I understand a lot of people would argue that you probably have hit, but I mean, I'm 49. I've learned that growing up, you know, I still grow up and learn lessons every single year, even though I think and I'm prepared, how can I make this mistake? I've learned it, but I still do.
Yeah.
Do you still find yourself in that position, Dylan?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I mentioned earlier about trying to delegate and get other people to do things. I'll look at a flight and I'm trying to go from A to B and I take 30 minutes to figure out the best flight. I'm like, why did I just
waste 30
minutes when the flight's going to get me there? It's going to be the same, whether it's an hour layover, 2 hours, like, doesn't really matter. Someone else can decide that for me. So little things like that take time away from my normal life. But I kind of pride myself on not making mistakes. I think that's, we talked about like forward progression and moving in a direction. If you have to learn a lesson 3, 4, 5 times, you're just slowing yourself down.
Yeah.
So there are many different ways that you can get from A to B. But if you keep making that same mistake, that distance and that time is just going to become greater and greater.
And if I have to ask your family that knows you very well, people and your friends, are you a little, what's fun about you and what's funny about Dylan? How do you have fun?
You'll have to
ask them. Is that part of your personality?
I find it very hard, honestly, to wind down and to not do anything. When I come back from a tournament, I literally just, I'll sit on my couch for a day or two. And first I have to organize everything in my house, make sure it's all taken care of and the mail's done and I've answered every email. But I sit down, I'm just like, okay, it's nice to be home and relax, but now what do I do? So luckily I've got some friends in Austin that keep me busy and friends back here. Arthur and I play a bit of paddle and I spend time with my family, but I find it very difficult to unwind and to do stuff. So it's also a fact that I'm single, so I don't have a wife or a girlfriend telling me, hey, we're doing this and that. It would be fun to have someone just to plan events and tell me where I'm going and what I'm doing. That'd be helpful. But I do enjoy surfing, like going to the West Coast now in America. I'm going to surf a bunch between tournaments. I do enjoy playing tennis, playing pickleball, playing paddle. So those things keep me active. And then I don't do much partying, drinking, social life in that aspect. I do like Austin FC, the soccer team in Austin now. So I go and watch every game that they have when I'm in town. And that's about it. I mean, I'm on the road 30 weeks a year, playing 27 to 31 tournaments a year. So I only have another 20 weeks to figure it out. And 4 or 5 of those are spent here in South Africa with family anyway.
I'm a very similar personality in that way. It doesn't always serve me well. Now that I'm 40 and at 30, I still got away with it. At 40 years old, you know, it's almost, I make people miserable around me because, you know, everything that I do and just like you, you know, I'm tend to go on holiday and 2 days later, literally start making my way back to the house or back to work to get things going.
Yeah.
It doesn't have an off switch.
Yeah, but I'm trying to fix that. Is there family and is that part of your life and vision for yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely want to have a wife one day, have kids. The way I see it is I'm going to give it my all now. I'm on the PGA Tour. It's been 5 seasons. This is a great opportunity, A, to make a bunch of money, B, to travel the world and see and meet new people. That was the main thing that I enjoyed about golf was I get to travel and I get to meet new people every week. So I don't think I could ever do a 9-to-5 job where I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. I would be bored in literally 10 days.
Yeah.
So for me, the opportunity is still there. Obviously, money is not much of an issue now. Like I can retire if I want to, but I'm still driven to earn money and like pay for stuff for my family and come back here and maybe set up a business and do things like that. So it's still a means to an end in a sense that I've got the skill, I've got this access. And hey, when I'm retired and 3-4 years out of the game, I can make phone calls and people are going to look at me like, yeah, we're not going to open those doors for you. You're not going to do this stuff. So I've tried to keep going on the golf side to have those opportunities and like commentary. I've done a bit of that stuff and trying to get into business and learn from other people that want to have access to a PGA Tour golfer or want to be surrounded by someone like me.
Well, talking about the PGA, what's the mood like on the PGA? So I understand there's been a lot of big tournaments fighting each other out for the last 12 months. Amateurs are, I think, a little bit overt. You know, we just want to watch golf.
Yeah.
We don't want to get too much involved in all the drama. But at the PGA Tour at the moment, what is the mood like at the moment? Has there been a change in the last year?
Yeah, I would say on the organization side, the business side, Jay Monahan's obviously had a lot to deal with, and then everyone below him, they're basically doing fire drills every now and then. So they've really, and I think it's a good thing. I noticed when I got there, I thought, this is a great organization. The PGA Tour is the top level, blah, blah, blah. And then I look at it, I'm like, they could do with a little shaping up here. Mm. There is some dead weight. There are some people that are not really doing their jobs from what I can see. And now this has kind of sped that up. Like, okay, we need to be doing our stuff or else we're going to lose out in this battle with the Live Tour. So that's been good. And then on the players' side, I think we don't worry too much. I mean, we still got tournaments to play and prize funds are going up. That's cool. The only thing that there is a bit of like jostling with is just the power dynamic between players. Right now, this whole Live thing has totally shifted the power from more of a consensus taking care of the group to taking care of the top 10% or the top 30, 40, 50 players. Those guys have agents. They have Jay Monahan's personal cell phone. They can call him whenever they want. So they've said, we need this, 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 and this, or else I'm out. I'm going to Live. So it's like, well, hang on. We need to cater to these guys, the top 20, top 30 guys. Who cares about the next 100 or 120 guys, which is the bucket I fall in? So we're sitting there like, well, hang on. We're making a little bit more money, prize money here, but all these little alterations to the money and the funds have really benefited the top few players. So we're sitting like, is this right? Is this a democracy? Is this fair? And it's interesting to see how guys or how willing they are to step in and try and fight for it. So we have a policy board. We have a structure of governance, but those top guys can sort of bypass that. And I brought this up to Jay Monahan in a meeting. I said, Jay, are you still happy with the structures in communication between the players from you down to us and us to you? And he said, no, everything's good. You go through a policy board and then the board. It's kind of not fair when someone can just get on the phone and call you and say, yeah, we need to change this, this, and this. But I have to go through three steps or three hurdles to get my point tabled to sit in front of the board for them to say yes or no. So I think that dynamic hasn't really been talked about in golf, and I'm trying to shed light on that because those top guys obviously don't want to have to deal with a democratic system. They just want more money. I want to make more money, play less, and that's the way they see it.
Sure. Thank you very much. It's nice insight. And so why then come to South Africa and play on the Sunshine Tour or a co-sanctioned event? Why even come to South Africa and play as an example on the Daniel?
Well, for me, number one, it's to play in front of South African fans. Yeah. I remember when I was a youngster,
that's so awesome.
I would go to a Sunshine Tour event like, oh, this is cool. These guys are pro golfers. Like, this is amazing. And then at the end of the year, oh, we got these international guys coming and I could see Ernie and Retief and watch them play. And for me, it was like, this is cool. But then once I play golf, I'm like, whoa, hang on. Now I can sort of measure myself. I can qualify for the SA Open, which I did when I was 16. And I played with Ernie, Retief, all those guys, not obviously in the same group, but I see, okay, we're playing the same golf course, same tees. Like, hang on, I made the same score as him on this hole. I beat him on this hole. I shot three shots, four shots worse than him. So for me, it's the example for the kids in South Africa. And how else are they going to grow and learn and develop their games unless they can compare it to somebody else? So, and obviously the fan element to that too, like entertainment, seeing people and being in front of them. And then the other factor is I'm going to come back here anyway for holiday and spend the time because I love South Africa. I love being here with my family. So weather's good. Hey, let's play a golf tournament or two. Why not? I enjoy playing golf as well. It's not just my job. Those are the main factors. And I think it's always tough for me when guys are like, oh, I'm going back to South Africa, but I'm not going to play. And I'm like, you kind of owe that to junior golf. You kind of have to, in my mind, you have to do that. But a lot of guys, a lot of the top guys, I understand they're tired, they want to take time off, but for me, just do two tournaments, somehow give back and set that example for the guys coming in the future.
I'm sure you'd like to win the S Open as well one day.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the number one tournament. I'm always going to play that when I'm back. Yeah, I don't think I'll ever skip the South African Open as long as I'm exempt or I get an invite for the tournament. That and a major are probably the last two sort of major achievements on my goal list.
And the difference between South African fans and American fans?
That's a loaded question. I mean, America's a big place, so the fans are totally different everywhere you go. New York versus California. But I think the South African fans are, I'd say, very knowledgeable. I mean, general sports, we know our sport very well. So even if it's some guy from Porvadersdorp that doesn't know much about golf, like, he's going to understand the game and he knows a few players and stuff. But in America, the PGA Tour events we play, is really only 20% of the fans out there that are watching golf. The other 80% are there because they've got a free ticket to the VIP booth, or they're just there for a social scene. Like, that's a lot of the fans in the US, which is fine because they're still paying for tickets, they're still paying drinks. But I feel like South African golf fans that are at the tournaments are more core golf fans. They understand the game and they know what's going on.
I've definitely picked it up. I was at Blair Athol the week before, and it's the amateurs sit there next to it in such awe, you know what I mean, when the guys walk past. And, you know, even so, you just sit there, it feels like, wow, this is actually happening on our show, and what you always see
on
screen.
That's the thing that I'm trying to achieve when I'm coming to play here. Like, I'm in America, cool, I have a few fans there, but like, most of my fans would be South African fans. So if I'm not gonna, they're not gonna fly to America and watch me there, the only way to do that is to come back and play here and try and create that sort of feeling.
Well,
Especially among the junior golfers, trying to inspire those youngsters.
Yeah, inspire those youngsters. And do you take a lot of the time when you come here to sort of pass a lot of that knowledge in a moment of to the junior golfers?
I played a practice round at the SA Open with Aldrich, Christian Maas,
Aldrich Portgieter,
and Jurav Premlal.
Yeah.
And
Premlal's very good well.
I try and do that when I come back to play with those amateurs. I'm going to try and make it a thing now when I come back to play with him. Christian Maas is at the University
of Texas. I was just going to ask you, so did you get, he's there also from next year, isn't he?
He started now this fall in August. Okay. He began. So he's a great player. And it made me think, like, hang on, when I was a youngster, I didn't really have any influence from the top pros. Like, I always try to latch onto a guy like George Kutsia, Darren Fickott. They practiced in Pretoria with me when I was there, had the same coach. And I would always try and, hey, let's have a chipping contest and try and be around them, because that's the only way, as I said, you can measure yourself and you can learn things and see how they do it. So I think when I come back now, I'm going to try to do that more often. For me to go and help a random junior member at my home club, like, that's not really going to have much of an effect, I don't think. I would do a seminar if there's 100 kids, but I try and pinpoint the kids that have potential, that seek me out, number one. If they're coming to me and saying, hey, Christian said to me, hey, let's play a practice run. 100%, bro, let's go. Bring the other guys. He walked up to me on the day and he said, hey, Yurov wants to play as well. Is that, 100%. Let him go. There's four spots. So we did that. I just think that's important as well, because what drives South African golf? What are the main factors? No one really knows. I mean, there's good coaches in South Africa. We've got good weather, good golf courses. But at the end of the day, if those people and those kids and those amateurs can't see other people achieving things, it doesn't give them the idea that, hey, maybe I can do that. That was my major thing, was Ernie, Retief, all these guys. If I tick off the things that they've ticked off over the years, I can get there. And that's really inspiring to know that, because then it's going to make me want to work, want to practice, want to do all the things that it takes.
So just like, I suppose, in business and golf, technology, environments, and et cetera, change as we go along. It's commercially driven or profit driven. Therefore, there will be innovation and new things coming out all the time. What was the difference? Did you see a big difference in today's youngsters and yourself? And what do you think is the biggest challenges that they face?
I think for me, you mentioned the technology and all that stuff. Now they have everything. When I was growing up, my dad bought me golf clubs. He had a choice of 3 different sizes in one golf company's junior set. Now I just bought my nephew some clubs, and it took me 30 minutes to try and figure out what clubs to get him, because there's so many options. So it's almost overwhelming sometimes to have all this stuff and know, what do I use? Do I use a TrackMan? Do I not? Do I invest in this? So they have a lot of information, and that sort of siphoning of information, coming to a decision on what to do, like, what golf coach do I do? Do I do a lesson a month? Do I do 3 lessons a week? Like, how do I do all this stuff? There's access to it. Previously, we were striving for information, trying to get it. My mom did a lot of research and, hey, what's the best way to go about this career? College golf. That's okay. We know nothing about the NCAA system. So how do we get that information? I think now the kids have so much information, it's more about discarding the information and sticking to the stuff that's actually going to help them. So for me, I mean, I'm trying to create a foundation here in South Africa that helps kids do that NCAA trip and give them information. And people ask me all the time, hey, what do you think? And I say, you can do just as well in South Africa. If you want to study and get a degree, yes, it's tough to balance the studies and the golf. But if you want to stay here and make the amateur team play golf RSA stuff, you've got stuff there for you. You can use a track man at some clubs. There's top coaches. You don't have to go to America, but to have that resource to know this is what America is about, this is what amateur golf in South Africa is about, I think that's key, just to simplify it for the kids so that they don't have to do the research. I mean, we did so much research figuring out what universities are good, how long, what, it's just, it's a whole.
Got to do the SAT exams.
Yeah, I mean.
Getting
yeah.
into college.
If yeah. I have to be selfish, definitely technology. And FlightScope, which is also, you know, a local brand on the launch monitor side. It's amazing what development that technology is doing, but I also see that you have to understand it.
Yeah, 100%.
You have to understand what you're training towards and what data parameter you need to know in yeah. order to improve. Otherwise, like you say, it gets a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, I always say, if you go to a fitman center, you know, Arthur, you go into a True Fit, I mean, you've got 200 different yeah. shafts and, you know, heads coming out from all of it. There is just simply no way, you know, that's like saying I'm going to be an insurance broker in a year's time and I have your skill. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So when you get there, it's so important that you rely on the person that you surround yourself yeah. with, that they guide you towards that. And I suppose that would be an advice in yeah. business. So for somebody that's actually walked that journey, and we spoke about it that on one of the podcasts, like if I'm a golfer today, how do I even get onto the Sunshine Tour?
Yeah.
You know, and something like you saying about winning the club champs, getting it's that experience.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love that, you know, because it's like school rugby or cricket, I suppose, yeah. or any sport for that matter. By the time you get to a senior level, the foundation of your yeah. school environment is what makes you a great player.
Yeah.
You know, you now just get a lot more attention, a lot more high access to information and skills and, yeah. and coaches and et cetera and et cetera.
And the guys don't just fall into that, right? When you're no. playing rugby, you play bullocky rugby, then yeah. you're playing some club stuff, then you're playing for your first team.
Geen schooner, dan met schooner.
There's defined paths that people take. So golf is sort of stratified in that effect that you have all these random golf clubs around the country, then you have the provincial bodies, and golf RSAs help not to try and keep yeah. it under one house. But I still don't think there's a curriculum. I even approached Golf RSA and said, hey, can we build some kind of document, some kind of curriculum for these kids? I mean, you probably have to do 5 different ones from
yeah.
a young junior's point of view to a top level amateur. Let's put it down in paper because we have this wonderful history in South Africa, but we haven't really put it down in writing. So let's just try and figure this out and have that there, because the other element is Johan Rupert is sort of the godfather of South African golf, and he puts a bunch of money in. But once he's gone, what do we have? We don't really yeah. have anybody at the top that's sort of defining the roles and defining the structures and making people work together. So if we can somehow get that stuff down in writing and have programs and have systems set up, it's going to be so much easier for it to develop over time and have some maintenance and not have to go through a 10-year cycle of, oh, crap, now our golfers are not good anymore. How do we fix this?
Dylan, you exceptionally, I enjoy this conversation so much. It's a great vision you've just given us there. Because I think, you know, for the average man on the street, that is sort of like what keeps us all together.
Yeah.
And I feel that some entities, most entities, it feels like they're all working individually for yeah. their own agendas.
Well, you mentioned this, there's a job, there's a business.
Yeah.
I mean, Arthur at True Fit, guys at different golf outlets, they're all trying to make money, but
yeah.
that's maybe not helping players get the best clubs in their hands possibly.
Yeah.
But if Golf RSA said, okay, you're a top-level amateur. We have one fitman guy on staff here, and he's the best in the country, and he's going to fit your clubs. Now we know our top 10 amateurs and juniors are going to have the best service, and they're going to have the perfect equipment. Right now they're going to each equipment supplier trying to get free clubs and do this and do that and get sponsored, but it could be a way to just get that even better, even more next level.
You know, what's important with that, because obviously there's some with access
yeah.
and there's some without. Do you think it's getting better on the without access?
Yes, that's what I said. Now it seems like there's a lot more information with the internet, with things that are readily available, podcasts we're doing now, guys can seek out that information. When I was yeah. coming through, I can't even remember where my mom got all the info from, but we obviously had some other golfers that had gone to college, that had played junior golf. Like when I started out, I knew there was the Junior Foundation, as it was called back then, and I'd play those tournaments, but we didn't know the provincial level, like what age groups there were to make teams. So we had to research all that stuff ourselves. But it would be nice to have some kind of database online. You can just click on it and see the whole sort of roadmap laid out in front of you. And that way, again, you feel inspired, you see the goals, you see everything in front of you. And that will definitely, in my mind, help the golfers that take it seriously, that want to get to the next level.
You know, as a, you're a heavily sponsored player,
yeah,
that with great brands behind you. One of the brands is Life Brand.
Life Brand, yeah.
But I was I laughed because it's helping you manage your social media.
Yes, yeah.
So let's just get into that quickly there, Dylan. How did you get into them?
They came to me. I still don't know what the major thing was. I asked their CEO and they're like, well, we liked your presence online and your Instagram account. And I was like, wow, that's impressive because I do all that myself. Like there's no help from anyone else. And they just liked what I'm about. So Life Brand is a cool business. They use AI technology to basically curate and go over all your social media accounts and see what maybe they flag posts, basically flag words, phrases, things that maybe you shouldn't put out there. Because every now and then, especially in America, some football coach put out a tweet 10 years ago and it's still there. And now he's fired because you can't say that type of stuff. So it's really cool technology that helps you out with that. And I mean, we actually haven't done a scan of all of mine yet, but I'm sure there'll be some stuff that'll come up.
I'm sure they'll get a bit busy and find some data in your posts.
Yeah.
Listen, the brands that are with you, you know, they don't need this platform for us to highlight them. But the reason I mention it is that social media is such a big part now of being a professional golfer.
100%.
And also it's same in business. You know, it's leaning more and more towards personalities. Yeah. If you look at the biggest companies in the world now are not institutions anymore. Yeah. It's individuals with personality and brands that form corporate companies behind them. You know, that eventually becomes the conglomerates that they are today. But social media is important. How are you? What is your approach on social media for yourself? You know, do you post because I need to be active? Do you post because I've got sponsors? Or is it something you really enjoy as an engagement
platform? It's a matrix. There's different elements. Okay. Obviously, in my contracts, they have a certain number of posts. I actually think I'm behind on my Life Brand posts. I need to get some more done before.
Well, there we go. We just gave them one.
But my key is to be authentic. I think if you're authentic and you put forward sort of the person and the personality you have, who cares whether you get a million followers or 10? That's the way I see it. A lot of people want to have coaches and there's some guys on the PGA Tour that have amazing looking pages. It's all curated. It's all pretty. It's got the music behind it and these cool visuals, but people know that's some guy sitting behind a laptop just creating all this stuff. So it's like, yeah, you might be the guy in the footage, but have you really done anything? No, it's just a media marketing company that's done it. So I like to engage with comment sections with people. I mean, that's probably the thing that I'm most famous for. People now at golf tournaments in the States are like, loved your comment, bro, blah, blah, blah. I haven't heard many negatives on course, but then I always get called out by the guys in the comment section. But for me, that's a way of interacting. Like that's what social media is about.
Yeah.
It's not just about having your page, X, Y, and Z pro golfer, look at my pictures, look at my sponsors. No, I mean, you send me a message, I might see it and I might respond. And I think people get a kick out of that, hey, this PGA Tour golfer is responding to me on a random comment section on Instagram.
Then it's important because what we do is we put you guys on a pedestal. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you just, human,
exactly.
Born,
exactly.
You know, 31 years old now. And in this life, your life just happened to be different.
Yeah.
Certainly steps that you and your parents took younger age got you to this particular point.
Yeah.
But that's what I really enjoyed about your social media. You know, there was this one where you just went into the gym. You can see there's no production behind it. It's just natural and organic. Big brands today, Dylan, they have to take the production out of it. The days of 17 directors to make one ad is gone.
Yeah.
You want real and authenticness. I always say to anybody, and you know, I can't speak from a sports perspective, certainly professional. When I say to business people, don't show me the C63, show me the factory you built in order to afford that. That's far more inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, show me that what you needed to do and the sacrifices you needed to make.
Yep.
To actually get to that particular point. The after effect of that is that I can go into a nice holiday.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, don't brag about it.
Yeah, look at my private jet.
Exactly, look at my private jet. You know, there's certain parts and I completely understand it, but if all you're doing is living from an ego perspective on it, you know, look at me, check-in first class, five-star hotel.
Yeah.
But in between that,
and that's the funny thing, you say that people expect that from me.
Yeah.
People always ask me, oh, why don't you show like the business class? And I'm like, why? You don't want to see that.
Why do I want to see that?
I'd rather show you the gym at such and such a golf course.
Then I can, I'll assume you can afford a business ticket. Okay. I'll assume that.
I can afford it, but I still don't fly business.
I was just going to say, agree with you. Dylan is one of those guys who will not fly business, even though he can.
Yeah.
If there's a benefit to it, if I'm playing a tournament, I need to be relaxed and rested when I get there. Sure. But if it's $900 for a nonstop flight and it's $5,000 for a business, I'd rather just pay the $900
and fly
around the aisle and stay active and and fly in the economy. I don't see the need for that. I mean, the next level is obviously now flying private and spending $10,000 an hour, $10,000 an hour. And that for me is also really hard to let go of. But sometimes there's a benefit to that. If you have a tight window between tournaments, you have to do that.
It's for golfers, but your personality seems very organized, not seem. It is very organized. You know, 31, it's not going to change.
Yeah.
What amazes me of golfers is that there's no fallback. So in between, you create opportunity, buy property, you know, get a bit into commentary or coaching.
Yeah.
But if you're not consciously aware of that, is it something within the golf world where, well, I've got no fallback. If I'm at 36 and I can't cut it anymore, my life experience is on the golf course.
Don't dictate much, I can coach golf or manage a golf club maybe.
Something like that. Is that something that's in the back of the mind of golfers? Because the percentage of golfers that make it, if you put it in a spreadsheet, it's scary. 0.00 You know, of golfers that actually make it. And I come back to what I said earlier when I found out that Tiger Woods only won 12% of all tournaments played. Then you thought, well, I thought it was bigger than that. Then you see the average after that is 4%.
Yeah.
So he was, you know, twice. Yeah, twice the you know, I just wanted to ask that on the golfer side, but I think you've answered it so well in the first conversations where you said you consciously have to prepare yourself for that life.
Yeah.
Because the other benefit of golf is you can play and make money basically until you can't walk anymore. Yeah. And if you've got the foundation young-wise in play, that will serve you for the rest of your life. And you see that in all golfers.
But you mentioned it. You said some guys, they don't have a backup. They don't have... So they keep playing golf. For me, I don't want to be 40 years old and still having to play golf. For me, my goal is to have three or four other revenue streams that are coming in that can support me, whether I'm actively managing that or not. And then B, I want to have the ability to step back. Maybe I have two, three kids and they're entering primary school and just look at my wife and say, you know what? I don't want to travel 30 weeks a year. Let's rather just chill out with the kids. So that's my motivating factor, is to be set up and ready and have those different avenues that bring in money that I can do it on the side and then maybe turn it into a full-time career. But I don't think many golfers think about that. They think it takes so much time and effort to do this job. But once you're sustainable, even if you have a Sunshine Tour card and you're constantly finishing in the top 30, dude, you have another 30 hours a week that you're not practicing. You could do another job. You could have a part-time job and do something else, or you could invest in a business and try and grow something. So I think guys are just lazy. Again, they just don't plan it out. They don't see their time schedule done properly. And before you know it, they're 38 years old and they're like, well, I haven't saved enough. I'm sort of struggling to play and now I need to find a job. So that's the same in business, in life anyway. There are people at the top that work and that are active and do all their stuff and get everything done. But then the vast majority of them just kind of float through life and that's just the way it is.
That bush tree driver shot.
Yes, yeah.
So a guy like you with your personality, I can't see you consciously thinking what I'm about to do is not the right move. But then it turned out to be not so.
There was no thought. So what you're referencing is a shot at Hilton Head where my ball got stuck in some moss, like 8 feet above the ground, 9 feet above the ground, found the ball luckily, and I had to play it. I asked the rules official. The ball's
moving. I was going to ask, you went up, you asked.
I said, ball's moving, am I allowed to hit it? Yes, you're allowed to because it's stationary in the moss. Okay, cool. Didn't think anything about it. Now I need it. This thing's swaying in the wind above my head. So I need to look at it and try and make contact with it.
I time it,
so
actually.
So I thought I'm going to take a driver because the face is as big as can be. Yeah. If I miss it, it's still going to fall out of the tree. So it's 3 feet above my head. Okay, I'm just going to grab this driver and just try and watch the ball. So I'm just standing below it, holding my hands up. Okay, and boom, and I hit it and just poked it out down the fairway. The rules official was standing 12 feet behind me.
You made par.
I hit it on the green with a 9-iron, made the putt for par. Greatest par of my life. And then 30 minutes after play, I get a phone call from the head rules official. And he says, now we're investigating this because we saw a video. Someone took a video behind me, directly behind me with my back turned, and the ball was above my head and my hands were up here. So they're like, it looks like you're standing. And I literally like shook my head. I'm like, I don't understand. What are you guys saying? They said, you're standing on your line of intended play. And I said, but how can that be? I'm trying to hit it forward in front of me. They said, yes, but like on a putting green, if you were standing behind the ball. And I'm like, but the ball's not on the ground. It's up in the tree. And we talked for like 20, 30 minutes. And they were like, what was your intent for this shot? Where were you trying to hit it? How? I said, guys, honestly, the ball's moving in the tree. My only intent was to hold this driver and watch the ball and try and at the right time just poke it out of the tree 20 yards in that general area, the size of a tennis court maybe, somewhere down there. Well, if you were aiming more left, then your line would be. And I said, look, if you really want to draw a line, my right foot, my right toes might have been below where that ball was, but this is totally ridiculous. And I literally said that to the rules official, this is ridiculous. Now we're referring it to the USGA. We need to get it right. We need to go ahead, do what you want. And then they came back to me and said, it's a 2-stroke penalty.
Yeah, Darren, I mean, if we had more time, I wanted to dive into that a little bit more because I just thought, what a bullshit call.
It's good on social media. I got a bunch of...
You got a bunch of, and I think a lot of amateurs as well, because now we're confused. Okay, so how are you supposed to approach this particular
I think the funniest thing was people saying that, oh, I never would have done that because I knew the rule. I would...
Bullshit.
No one in the world that would think about that, approaching that ball.
But that was like a rule. I'm not specifically quoting, but like a 12.1.4.7.
There was no ruling on that rule. It was now put in, okay, now you can't do it. And I thought of so many other scenarios where that could be the case. Your ball could be under a bridge and you could be lying on your stomach on a bridge trying to hit a ball like this.
But that's exactly what I'm...
Directly above the ball. So then you can't do that. Sorry.
I've seen shots out of the water that would be just as risky. Or
you could have a tree behind you and the only way forward is facing your target zone and hitting it next to you and going
we've seen that so many
facing your target.
Exactly.
What is the difference?
What is the difference between that whatsoever?
The difference is mine was caught on camera and there's three rules officials scrutinizing it like this. That's the only difference.
I think a little bit of drama.
Yeah.
Okay, so I will just finish on this because I know you guys need to go. But in 2021, your ball speed gained.
Yeah.
So I actually want to ask why.
There's three different avenues to it. And the simple answer is, one, I switched to a longer driver. Callaway hooked me up with a 40, it was just over 46, 46 and a half inches. Now I've had to cut it back a little bit. The second part was training in the gym. I started doing some speed training. Previously, I'd only done strength and power training. And then the third aspect was my intent over the ball. I try to hit it hard most of the time when I was hitting driver. So between those three factors, it gave me about 5 miles an hour club speed. So that was the short answer.
Was there purpose behind that?
Yeah, like, I was going to say.
Were you looking for more gain, ball speed, club head speed for a purpose?
But or why?
To hit it longer.
Okay.
To score lower. Okay. To make more money.
Okay. So to hit past the shit. Higher. To hit past the shit.
Just
is that part of it?
The opportunity just to hit it at 320 as opposed to 300 on the fly. So that was my goal, just gain some more distance. I just won on the PGA Tour. So, hey, I've got a 2-year exemption here. Let's use that time and see what I can do. And that's basically stuck with me. That speed hasn't diminished. I haven't tried to push it even more.
Yeah.
I could probably do another little speed cycle, but I don't think I need to. I'm 120 club speed now on a normal given day at just under 46 inches on the shaft. And I'm totally happy with flying it 305 yards right now.
Well, Dylan, from my perspective, this felt almost like so I just want to say your son at 31, his maturity, his view in life, and it's just amazing. I surround myself with a lot of people that has had some success in their lives, and your son and you can clearly, what's your mother's name?
Jenny,
you guys have done a tremendous job. And Dylan, thank you for this morning, because there's so many things that South African golfers are going to relate to, professionals that they can actually hear. And
see when I'm back in South
Africa. And see, because, and hopefully I ask some of the questions that when you're on the course, it's completely different. You never want to ask those questions.
Yeah.
You guys are always in focus mode. You know, I walked past you the other day. I wouldn't even dare, stick my hand out to say good morning, because you don't know what frame of mind you're in at the moment. And I think if you've been long golf long enough, you let the guys just be what they are. But thank you for this morning, and thank you for the contribution that you do for South Africa and sport as a whole. It's extremely inspiring, and your discipline is incredibly inspiring. And I want to say to both of us, me and you, a challenge maybe for 2023 is that we also just remember to have a bit of fun.
We need to have a bit of fun and relax.
And what I've learned with that, it's not a statement of saying let's be loose, but it actually is more productive in your life. And the people around you also need it, because not everybody is always like us. Yeah. So that would be a personal challenge for you.
I'll take that. We can discuss it.
We can discuss that as we go along. Maybe we'll check in with each other.
We'll check in next year this time.
Yeah.
We've left out a lot of topics that we
still We've left out a lot of topics.
You've got you welcome in the seat anytime.
Yeah.
Good. I'll be back, boys.
And Dylan, all the best to you for this year. Whatever you're going to be throwing for yourself and whatever your mindset is and your goals for this year, we bless you. We bless the journey. And thank you for not forgetting about South Africa and coming to play here on our grounds, and for allowing us to interact with you on the course and see you physically on African soil. It was absolutely amazing to do that. And thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, you're welcome, Albert Arthur. Thanks for having me. It was good fun. We'll do another one next year.
Arthur, thanks a lot. We're not going to hit our shot today.
We're going to get our chance.
We'll have our time.
What's going to happen now is I'm already $400 on the paddle court up against him. We might have to go double or quits this afternoon.
We'll figure it out.
Listen, this man's discipline, I think I'll put my $400 here with Dylan.
You'll come up with a tactic or two.
I'll figure out the paddle.
Thanks a lot, guys. Much appreciated.
On the next episode of the Human Golf Show.
Like, I respect golfers, man. Honestly, it's from motocross to this. Motocross, I was 90% on a high. Yeah, I'm facing disappointments and failure every day of my life. And just what keeps me going is motivating people and showing people that whatever you put your mind to is possible.